Our brother Bill has asked that I read from the Psalms, Psalm 148, verses 1 through 6. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord from the heavens. Praise Him in the heights. Praise Him, all His angels. Praise Him, all His host. Praise Him, sun and moon. Praise Him, all you shining stars. Praise Him, you highest heavens, and you waters above the heavens. Let them praise the name of the Lord, for He commanded and they were created, and He established them forever and ever. He fixed their bounds which cannot be passed. So now I'll introduce Brother Bill.
So I have some news. Just before I came up here, Brother Dan Richard came to me and said that the news on Yahoo, the big story is there's been a major solar storm on the sun. So stay tuned. You know. So what we want to talk about tonight, we want to talk about something called the vital shield. And before we get to that, it's a fairly complex story to get to it. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the electromagnetic spectrum. And the electromagnetic spectrum has only really been understood for just over maybe 120 years, maybe less. The region of it that we are familiar with, of course, is the electromagnetic spectrum in the visible range. I just want to show you what a small part of the total electromagnetic spectrum that the visible range really is. We'll just look at this little video for a second here. Do we have sound? There's sound, but we'll get to it. Okay, I'll just tell you what's going on. We're talking about the distance of the electromagnetic spectrum if it was measured in miles. And this would be a movie tape running 2,500 miles from somewhere in California up to Alaska. And they're going to show us what portion of that 2,500 miles the visible spectrum is of the total electromagnetic spectrum. So here he comes. He's going to cut just one frame of a 2,500 mile tape. And that represents, out of the entire electromagnetic spectrum, the visible spectrum. So that's what a small part of the total spectrum that the visible light is. And I think we're just going to move on here. So when we come to the visible spectrum, we are... spectrum here, if we can get it to work. Sue, are we ready to go here? This may or may not work. Can you just hit the blank key, Trent? This may not work. I had two identical packages at home, one with a large projector in it, were designed to work with this water prism, and one that had something unrelated to that, and I brought the wrong box. So we're going to go with a much lesser light source here, and we'll see what happens. We're getting a little bit, and thank you. And maybe it's just as well we're getting such a thin spectrum, because as you know, white light, the red on the lower frequency, the violet on the upper frequency, is a very narrow band in the total electromagnetic spectrum. And perhaps it's just as well that that's what we've got here tonight. It reflects reality. So, thank you very much. The visible spectrum is indeed a very narrow band. But you see, man didn't know anything about the other parts of the spectrum until really very recently. And I want want to show you what the consequences were of that lack of knowledge. You see, mankind did not know that when you get up on the shorter wavelengths towards gamma radiation, X-rays, what it meant for life, and it's not good news. And so it was that when the Curies discovered radium, man, that was a nice substance. You know what? You could put it together with zinc sulfide and you could get some terrific looking faces on the clock. And so it was that many women found work working in these factories, and they painted those numbers and those hands on the clocks. And to save money, they licked the brushes with the radium on them. The body sees radium like it sees calcium, so it went right into their bones with that high-level gamma radiation. And the result was that many of them died very painful deaths from cancer as a result of not understanding what the electromagnetic spectrum could do to them. On top of that, you could buy topical face cream, which would certainly make your face glow. It would do other things as well. And this particular gentleman, let's just read what he did. Evan McMurray Byers was a wealthy American socialite, athlete, and industrialist. In 1927, while returning by a chartered train from the annual Harvard-Yale football game, Byers fell from his berth and injured his arm. He complained of persistent pain, and the doctor suggested he take Radithor, a patent medicine containing high concentrations of radium. Byers drank nearly 1,400 bottles over 3 years. By 1930, when Byers stopped taking the remedy, it was called, he had accumulated significant amounts of radium in his bones, resulting in the loss of most of his jaw. Byers' brain was also abscessed and holes were forming in his skull. He died from radium poisoning in 1932. It wasn't just the gamma rays, however. X-rays, nobody really understood the dangers of X-rays either. And so it was that when Röntgen discovered them in about 1895-96, and he was, here is a picture of him using it, dentists in particular, hey, this is a great new thing. We can now see people's bones, we can see their teeth, hey, let's get going. What people didn't understand, because they didn't understand the spectrum, was how dangerous they really were. The loss of sight, cancerous disease, and even death may come to him as constantly exposed or inexperienced, and use of Röntgen rays has been demonstrated in a pitiable manner in the laboratory of Thomas A. Edison at Orange, New Jersey. Clarence Daly, an assistant to the Wizard of Menlo Park, has contributed an arm and a hand to this demonstration, while Mr. Edison himself suffers from the disturbed focus of one of his eyes through experiments with this mysterious light in an endeavor to find for it some economic commercial utility. So it was that those who were involved with X-rays in the early going paid a price, particularly dentists. As early as 1900, a physician had been using X-rays in his practice, described the irritating effects of X-rays. He recorded that erythema and itching progressed to hyperpigmentation, ulceration, neoplasm, and finally death from metastatic carcinoma. The entire process spanned a period of 9 years. Cancer of the finger was an occupational disease common among dentists before the carcinogenic properties of X-rays were well understood. Dentists would hold the dental X-ray film in the mouths of patients while X-raying their teeth, patient after patient holding those X-rays in the mouth, they had cancer of the fingers from doing that. So I want to just move down the spectrum now to the radio network. We're going to look at two examples from World War II where how people understanding of the electromagnetic spectrum had an impact on things. The first one was in Britain, and I have a point. And what it was the Germans had a beam from Germany which they beamed right into London, England. And they set a second beam up in France. And that being when the beams crossed, when the bomber pilots in the darkness could detect that those beams crossed, they dropped their bombs. So the Brits decided to put up their own beam system, and where they put it was, they put it in London, near London, but they put it here, and they beamed it that way, so that when the Germans came in their planes, they had a cross beam here, which was well east of London, and they dropped their bombs there instead of on London itself, and the Brits responded by lighting fires in the fields to make the German bombers think that they hit their targets. So Churchill estimated that in the early going, it saved direct hits on civilian and military installations by about 80%, simply because somebody understood the electromagnetic spectrum and how to use it. Now we're going to go to the electromagnetic spectrum. We're going to do a little demonstration here. We might as well come up. Okay, so who's going to, who wants the lights? You're going to toss? You toss. Okay, let's go. So what we're going to look at is what the Germans were looking at over Hamburg, Germany one night. Okay, here's a light. Here's a light. Here's a light. And here's a light. Okay, let's go over here. Who's tossing? Okay, let's go over here. Turn on your lights. Yeah, okay, okay, let's go. Two over here, two over here. Okay, put your lights on. Okay, so what happened was the British understood the frequency of the German radar over the city of Hamburg. And just give me one. And what they did was they made 92 million strips, just like this, that were tuned to the German radar. In other words, the frequency of the wavelength that the German radar used was exactly this, about 12 inches long, and they made the strips a half an inch wide. They put black paper on the back so that the strips would remain at that length perfectly. It didn't fold or bend. And that resonated with the German radar. And so one night they sent in 700 bombers with 92 million pieces of what was called window. And all we can show here is what the German searchlight saw. So you throw them up, you've got to try to catch his stuff as he throws it up. So look at what he's doing and see if you can catch the stuff now. Throw it up as high as you can. Ready? Way we go. So put your lights up. Let's try it again. You pick it up somewhere and try it one more time. I'm going to explain to the audience what was going on. Let's do it one more time. This is what the German searchlight saw coming down. Okay, you ready? Give it to him here. Okay, now see if you can get what the searchlight saw. All these pieces of foil coming floating down to the earth. Ready? Get your searchlights ready. Okay, let's go. Up. There we go. Okay, thank you very much. But that isn't what the German radar saw. The bombing of Hamburg, Germany in July 1943 and the use of window. The British were debating its use. Churchill finally approved the use of window, aluminum foil strips attached to black paper. Tune. I want you to repeat something for me. Tuning matters.
Tuning
matters on that spectrum. So how did Churchill approve the attack? Very well. Let us open the window. How Churchillian. When British bombers flew over Hamburg, they pushed tens of thousands of these strips out into the air, totally confusing the German radar. Over the next few days, 50,000 people died in the firestorms that were caused by the bombing, as the city was virtually defenseless with its radar blinded. So what the radar saw was, instead of just being able to pick out a plane, suddenly their screen was totally filled with these strips tuned to the exact frequency they used, and they couldn't change it. They had captured, the British had captured somebody that knew of, had used this system and told them the frequency. And as a result of that, they were able to pretty well fly for 4 nights without much in the way of interference from the German. So as you move down to the right, you get down into here, you don't have any problems with health. But it's this area here, and it's this tricky area right here, ultraviolet, just above the visible range, which we're going to be talking about a little bit this evening. And the reason that that is an interesting area, we'll get to, but we're going to first of all do some demonstrations with ultraviolet. So we'll have the first person up here. How are you?
Good.
Okay, so we're going to do something pretty simple. What do you see here in these two dishes? Yeah, okay, so here's an ultraviolet light. It isn't going to hurt you. I want you to put that on and just shine it on those. So you can see that depending on where the frequency is, you will find that ultraviolet light has the energy to cause what's called fluorescence. So that's just a very simple demonstration that what occurs in white light and what occurs when you go up the spectrum a bit is really quite different. Different wavelengths depend at different times. I'm sorry, that's all. Thank you. So we're going to now look at the response of the same idea, this time using plastic. Who's ever next? We have these little beads here. As you can see, under normal light, they're perfectly white. I want you to shine this light on them for a while. We're going to energize, and they have a dye in them. So hold it close, move right in. It'll take a minute here. But under the effect of ultraviolet light, there's a dye in those beads. They're starting to change color. Just move it up a little wee bit. You can see that the beads are starting to change color. They're absorbing the ultraviolet energy. You can see them now turning quite different colors. And that is because those particular dyes are energized in a way that it'll disappear once we take the ultraviolet away. But those beads are absorbing that particular frequency of light, tuning matters, and because of that, they're changing color. Okay, thank you, sir. Much appreciated. Okay, now we're going to show you how you can expose a lie by using the spectrum. And we're going to have the principal of the school come in to find out who stole the money. That's going to be Horst Trusted. I'm going to return in a few minutes with a slightly different persona. So I'll disappear. And I won't know who the guilty party is.
Understand somebody stole a dollar. So one of you four folks here are responsible for that dollar. Who's going to fess up that did it?
I didn't do it.
You didn't do it?
Nope.
How about you?
No.
You didn't do it? You didn't do it?
Nope.
And you didn't do it. Well, I know that one of you did it. So how are we going to fix this problem? I can get the torture rack out and start torturing you. Would that answer it? But I have a better idea. Let's call Sherlock Holmes on this job.
Okay.
Cool.
Well,
it looks like one of our four friends here has stolen a dollar, and no one agrees that they took it.
Is that right? Well, these are always difficult cases.
They certainly are.
I'll tell you what.
That's why we brought you in.
Tell you what. We'll use the spectrum to find the thief. So I want you to all come over here. Put your hands there. All four. Hands up. So let me have a look here. Let me have a look under an ultraviolet light. I think we found the guilty party right here. Because that bill was... No?
There it is. Okay. I don't know. The one on the left.
I can't tell. Without
it. Oh, there it is. Sorry, that's it right there. There's the guilty party. Can you come with me, will you please?
Without any screening. You want to just look at right here, over here, just shine that. Okay, so without any screening, obviously the ultraviolet is energizing them and the electrons fall back to see it in the visible range. I want you to bring it right over top now. It's not, you'll see that the shielding, it's not perfect, but it is, in fact, we're taking it, put it right over those beads again. You can see once we put the shield on, you can screen out ultraviolet light of all frequencies. Thank you. And that's really... that's really why life on this earth is able to exist, as we'll now talk about, because the sun... the sun emits its radiation, and here is the visible range, which is what we are familiar with right here. However, it emits over here in infrared, which provides the warmth we feel from the sun. But more dangerously, it emits ultraviolet radiation right in this range here. And the problem with that is that the DNA in all living organisms absorbs ultraviolet light very strongly in this 250, 260 range. So if there was not a shield to prevent that particular radiation from the sun coming to Earth, none of us could make it because it would jam up our DNA, and that's pretty well the end of the line. So I want to just... ultraviolet radiation does this nasty thing. It provides energy at a certain level so that the bonds, this bond here, which normally shouldn't be there, forms. And that can cause us living organisms great difficulty because the DNA code is getting jammed. Now, fortunately, all living things, thousands of times a day, have an automatic built-in DNA correction system to correct these very kinds of problems. But if you get into the area of 250, that range we were talking about, it'll kill everything. Now, how effective is this? Well, Best Western Hotels, just June 1st, they are going to sterilize from now on in their hotels. They're going to use these ultraviolet wands on highly touched areas such as telephones, bathroom fixtures, and light switches. It does work. It will kill bacteria because it absorbs in that critical range, 250 nanometers, and that will destroy living things. Here again, and this is why the ozone layer, which we're talking about this evening, is so vitally important. There's the frequency that life cannot live under. This frequency right in here, the 250 nanometer range. The visible range is over here, and you're moving up towards X-rays and gamma rays over here. But right here, and up here, I might say, our atmosphere, nitrogen, oxygen, water vapor, will absorb everything up here, and when you get over here, it's not dangerous. But right there is dangerous. It will kill life. Isn't it interesting that that is where ozone absorbs most heavily? Here we are at 240, 250, 260. The ozone layer absorbs UV radiation at exactly the place where life is weakest, where it would destroy it. And without this layer, we wouldn't be here. It's just that simple. So here's from Rice University what they say about it. Ozone is a gas in the atmosphere that protects everything living on the Earth from harmful radiation rays from the sun. Without the layer of ozone in the atmosphere, it would be very difficult for anything to survive on the surface. Think of a very bad sunburn, only much worse. Plants cannot live and grow in heavy ultraviolet radiation, nor can the plankton that serve as food for most of the ocean life. The ozone layer acts as a shield to absorb the UV rays and keep them from doing damage at the Earth's surface. Now the rub about this is, but we're going to spend the rest of the evening talking about, there's a big problem with this from an atheistic point of view. And the problem is that you need oxygen to start to create your O3. And it's that problem of oxygen that we're going to address. So that layer is up there. It doesn't block out all, it blocks out all the higher radiation to the UVC at around 250. As we move towards the visible spectrum, it does not block everything. Some of the UVB, which comes through, which causes sunburn, which is getting down the, it's not as high frequency as UVC, it's slightly lower frequency, and UVA comes through without causing us much problem, and right after UVA, you're getting into blue light over here. Those people who are born without the enzymes to repair damage from UVB radiation, they don't have the repair mechanisms. If they go out in the sun, they will develop cancer very quickly because the skin is damaged and there's no repair mechanism to repair it. If we didn't have those elaborate repair mechanisms, it wasn't a part of all life, we wouldn't be here, regardless of the ozone layer. But one of the results of the space program has been that these suits have been developed for people suffering from this genetic deficiency, and they can now go outdoors, although not exactly in a bathing suit. So, the real problem, even before you get to the ozone layer, and that's where we're going to spend the rest of this evening talking about, is where did the oxygen on the Earth come from? Because that has become a huge issue in the last 10 years when mankind has been looking out at exoplanets. What makes another planet habitable for life? And the big issue, there's several issues, but the big issue we're going to be talking about tonight is where did the oxygen come from? This is where we're going to spend our time. Now in the last few years, as a result of the looking out into space, There have been a few books written just about oxygen, interestingly enough. This book is called Oxygen, the Molecule That Made the World. That's an interesting title for a book. Why would that be written? We'll show you why that was written. This was written last year, 2001, Oxygen and the Evolution of Life. Well, what's the big deal with oxygen? It's a real big deal. A real big deal. Revolutions That Made the Earth in 2011. It deals, as we'll see, with the whole question of oxygen, how it came to be on this earth. Now, this demonstration here is the single most important demonstration of the 3 days that I'm going to be up here. And we're going to have our next candidate come forward. We want to put the lid on this in a hurry because it's going to generate some gas that we really don't want to be breathing. So this is steel wool. Have you got your waiver sign? Steel wool. I'm going to do this quickly because we do not want to be breathing that gas too quick. So this is white vinegar. I want you to pour in, oh, maybe up to, say, an inch. A little more than that. Okay. Now I want you to pour in a little bleach. A little more than that. Okay. And let's cap it. Cap it quickly. Okay. We'll just watch that for a minute. Thank you. We'll just keep an eye on that. We'll let it go. Thank you. This is a high school and college experiment. You'll see already that something's happening to the steel wool. It's being oxidized, which is a fancy word for saying rust. The problem with explaining oxygen on this earth is that it's a reactive gas, and it doesn't hang around. It combines immediately with other elements in the periodic table. So when we come to consider how it is that there's oxygen on the face of the earth, there's been an enormous literature in the last 10 years in particular on this subject. If we can go back to the PowerPoint here, you'll see that the rusting is occurring very quickly here, and in a few minutes we'll come back and look at it. You'll see that it's nearly completely rusted because of the combination of liquids that we put in there. So, this is from this year, Astrobiology 2012, and this woman, who's the leading authority, a woman named Sarah Seeger at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, here is the problem explaining why there's oxygen on this earth. She says the gas is O2 and its photolytic product O3 that provides the protective shield have been widely discussed in the literature as biosignature gases. That's just a fancy word that means if you're looking for life on other planets, you're looking for oxygen is what you're looking for. With Earth-like composition, oxygen and its photolytic product O3 are the most reliable biosignature gas indicators for life as we know it. O2 is highly reactive and therefore will remain in significant quantities in the atmosphere only if it is continually produced. Otherwise, it combines with other elements and it's not in the atmosphere. It's not in a breathable form. We can't breathe rust. So what she's saying here, and this is very, very important. This is 2012. I've tried to make my information current. Oxygen will remain in significant quantities in the atmosphere only if it is continually produced. Got that? It has to be continually produced in high quantities, or it just binds with the other elements and isn't available in the atmosphere. The major sink of O2 and O3 is surface reactions. Translation, it'll bind with other elements. There are no known abiological mechanisms that can continually produce large quantities of oxygen. Translation, only life can produce oxygen. Only life. And that's why when they're looking out at these planets and so forth, trying to see what the atmosphere is, they're looking for oxygen in that atmosphere, because that would be a sure sign that life is there. The theists and the non-theists both agree that living organisms are the source of the current oxygen levels in the Earth's atmosphere. Both then have to agree that photosynthesis is the sole mechanism which has generated the quantity of oxygen in the atmosphere upon which all oxygen-consuming organisms depend. Breathe in. We depend on oxygen. So this process is an extremely complex process, but we are going to look at a couple of things that you may find of some interest in deciding whether you're a theist or a non-theist. So this is the basic cycle. It's an enormously complex process, and we simply can't dumb it down tonight. So we're just going to give the very, very highlights. The carbon dioxide and water in the presence of this photosynthetic system and light produce carbohydrates, glucose, and provide this critical oxygen. And the only molecule in existence that can take that light energy and transfer it into this elaborate system is chlorophyll. Chlorophyll. And what do we know about chlorophyll? Chlorophyll has been described as the most important molecule on the Earth. It's got a magnesium core here. And this is this molecule upon which we are dependent for oxygen. So here's the question. What do we know about oxygen? Well, it's been synthesized once by man. And I want to tell you some about the qualifications of the individual who did it. He was an American. He entered MIT at 16, was bored, so he dropped out. MIT invited him back, and he agreed on the condition that he could set his own curriculum. How many of you students are going to advise your university what you're going to study? He received his Bachelor of Science at age 19 and his PhD at 20. Many of Woodward's syntheses were described as spectacular by his colleagues, and before he did them, it was thought some of them would be impossible to create these substances in the lab. He received the Nobel Prize in 1965 for chemistry, and here's what they said at the time he got the prize. The synthesis of a complicated molecule is, however, a very difficult task. I want you to just notice that, difficult task. Every group, every atom must be placed in its proper position, and this should be taken in its most literal sense. It is sometimes said that organic synthesis is at the same time an exact science and a fine art. Here, nature is the uncontested master, but I dare say that the prize winner of this year, Professor Woodward, is a good second. So essentially what he did, he reverse engineered nature. That's what he did. So, the laboratory synthesis of chlorophyll is an extremely intricate process. It is a test of intelligence applying itself to matter to come up with a desired product. Robert Woodward won the Nobel Prize for essentially reverse engineering what he found in the natural world. In this case, he and his associates took nearly 5 years to do so. And in fact, if you put the person time together, the people involved, it was about a 15-year process to reverse engineer this one molecule in nature. And it's never been done since. I asked Sister Martha King to do a database survey looking for anything to do with chlorophyll synthesis, and there has not been since he did this in 1960. It took him 5 years, but 15 years of research time in total. Now, this particular individual was a genius in organic chemistry, and the height of his genius was he synthesized vitamin B12, one of the most complex natural products, natural molecules in all of nature. We're going to look at the speech he gave. It's not the greatest copy, but I want you to listen very carefully the number of people involved and how long it took them to synthesize from scratch vitamin B12. There it is. Here we go.
The investigation when you want to exclude absolutely rigorously losses from a moisture, from a reaction on a 50 microgram scale. That's a chemist that can do that.
So I think you get some sense of the complexity of what we're talking about here. I estimate it took 500 person years to synthesize B12. Because if he had PhD students working for me at 99 over 11 years, if they each worked, say, 4 years working on their degree, 4 to 5 years, it took 500 person years to synthesize B12. And you'll notice what he says, that you have to guide those reactions, because organic chemistry, if you don't understand exactly, I'm not an organic chemist. I do understand at the very high level synthesis, you get the wrong products all the time, and they had that all the time. They got 10 years in, and one day they both in Europe and at Harvard, they both went the wrong way, and they had to go back several steps. It was 81 steps they had to go through to create the B12 molecule. So the question is, how is it then that living systems, organisms, can create these molecules virtually instantly, flawlessly, on demand? Well, we're going to take a little bit of a side detour before we get back to photosynthesis, because I want to talk for a few minutes about a discovery or a book that was written by a man by the name who goes by the pseudonym Mike Jean. Mike Jean is a professor at one of the big Eastern University Ivy League schools, and he got involved in the intelligent debate discussion about 10 years ago, and out of that, in 2008, he wrote this book called The Design Matrix, A Consilience of Clues. And basically what he said was, you have to consider intelligent design, Richard Dawkins aside, and he raised two issues. It's a long book, 300 pages. Here were the two issues he raised. Number one, life runs on machines. That's the first point he made. The second point he made was, life has an extremely complex information processing system within it, many of which mimic some of the most advanced computer programming humans do, and therefore on those two bases, he said, you have to consider intelligent design. Now, for an Ivy League professor, he hasn't given his name, and here's why he said he hasn't, but he would have come under such tremendous flak. He says, my decision to stick with my pseudonym is because it pays tribute to a personal belief I hold dear. As I have repeatedly argued on the internet, I'm not going to make any appeal to qualifications or training. If I have no qualifications or relevant training, this may cause some to dismiss or overlook a good argument for this reason alone. If I do have qualifications and relevant training, this may cause some to embrace a bad argument for this reason alone. I would rather let the argument stand on their own to be evaluated without prejudice. And so what he said was this. When man started into the field of nanotechnology to try to create machines, atom by atom, and one of the leaders of this was a man by the name of Eric Drexler, nanosystems, molecular machinery manufacturing and computation. When man started down this road, he found that they already existed, nanomachines, in that device called life. That's what they found. So here's what he says about that. It is quite significant that life is machine dependent. Did you know that? Did Richard Dawkins ever say that when he was machine dependent? Nearly every major processing taking place in a cell is mediated by these molecular machines. Since our experience links the existence of machines with intelligence, that life is machine dependent further supports the suspicion of intelligent design. Now he says, if astronauts were to land on Mars and discover an odd object that upon analysis would be best described as some type of machine, most people would infer that the machine was built and designed by an intelligent agent. So when we see a machine, we think that intelligence is behind it. Now he published in his book this particular diagram, and what he said was, as nanotechnology started to develop, and people were starting to look into it, you'll see coming along here, all of a sudden, the use of molecular machine as applied to biology went through the roof in PubMed. Why? Because what they were trying to create in the lab and what they saw in life were the same thing. The machines already exist in life. That's what they are. And so he has a list here, there's just a few, of the places and just journal articles that he selected where the term machine, assembly manual, whatever, had to be used naturally to explain what the writer was talking about. Molecular tweezers, scissors, pumps, motors, levers, valves, pipes, chains, and even vehicles abound. But of course, the cell is more than a bag of gadgets. The various components fit together to form a smoothly functioning whole, like an elaborate factory production line. The miracle of life is not that it is made of nanotools from nanotechnology, but that these tiny, diverse parts are integrated in a highly organized way. And so I look at a few science sites every day, pretty much. And this is from June 10, 2012, just 3 weeks ago. Enabling bioengineers to design what? New molecular machines for nanotechnology is one of the possible outcomes of a study. In order to survive, all creatures, from bacteria to humans, monitor and transform their environments using small protein nanomachines made of thousands of atoms. And that's what nanotechnology is about, making machines from atoms. So let's look at a production line here. Now the reason I showed that is that in fact life itself works just the same way, only at the nano level. It's an integrated production line. For example, the production of chlorophyll, which took 15 years of human beings to assemble, who were brilliant at their field, by the way, it requires 17 enzymes or machines and an assembly line to synthesize chlorophyll. But here's the problem. Many of the intermediates along the way are molecules that are toxic. They'll kill the cell. Unless, just like on that production line, as the one item is made, it's immediately snatched away by the next machine and modified, and so on and so forth. And then you come out at the end with the chlorophyll molecule after going through 17 steps. B12 in living cells is about 30 steps. It was 81 when they had to synthesize it in the lab. The entire process has to be carefully coupled to avoid any leakage into the cell. If any of these toxic intermediaries, as we go from one enzyme to the other to finally synthesize the entire chlorophyll molecule, it would kill the cell. It's just that simple. It has to be coupled from one machine to the next in order that the cell does not die in the process. So here is an ATP system, and the similarity, this is how someone took a nano machine that makes ATP synthase and blew it up, as it were, to a macro machine. And this is how they visualize. We're running on slow speed here and I can't speed it up, but this control panel at the bottom, we can really get this thing moving if we just, it looks, the thing I would wanted you to see is that candy production line and this ATP synthesis production line, they're very, very similar in the way they look. One's a machine and so is the other. And machines don't arise by themselves. So, at the front end, we need this chlorophyll molecule. It is the only one that can capture the light. Of all the molecules in nature, it is the only one that can take the light and capture it and immediately pass the energy on the way of that photon, pass the energy on to this elaborate system, the end result of which is oxygen, water, and of course this glucose, the energy source for all living things. And we depend on this system, this photosynthetic system, for all life here. The point we're going to be concentrating on is where this oxygen comes from, but nevertheless, it just can't be dumbed down to a level that we can all understand, because it is simply an irreducibly complex system. Now, just like it's been known before, but the complexity of the system, it involves quantum mechanics. Using ultra-fast spectroscopy, the researchers observed the subatomic interaction of the initial stage of photosynthesis, which can take place in less than a trillionth of a second. I don't know what a trillionth of a second is. To their surprise, they discovered a never-before-seen quantum effect whereby a single photon aroused different chromospheres simultaneously. The behavior we were able to see at these very fast timescales implies a much more sophisticated mixing of electronic states, Teed said. It shows us that high-level biological systems could be tapped into very fundamental physics in a way that didn't seem likely or even possible. It's tapped right in, it looks to me, to the structure of the periodic table. Now look at what he says. And I wanted you to focus on this. I don't know who this man is, what his views of the world are, but here is what he says. The quantum effects observed in the course of the experiment hint that natural light harvesting process involved in photosynthesis may be more efficient than previously indicated by classical biophysics. It leaves us wondering, how did Mother Nature create this incredibly elegant solution? Well, how indeed did it happen? The origin of photosynthesis is a real challenge for the non-theist. If it appears that it could not have arisen by some naturalistic route, get this, listen carefully. If you can't explain photosynthesis and the production of oxygen, you don't have a theory of life here. Because without oxygen, you can't have oxygen breathers. That's why it's become such a big issue. That's why when they're looking out at exoplanets, they're looking to find oxygen in the atmosphere. Because without oxygen, you just can't have life, given the periodic table we have. Well, perhaps a few organisms that use sulfur. But basically, any advanced form of life, because of the energy requirements, you cannot have oxygen-breathing organisms living on the Earth without this photosynthetic process. Now, it was refreshing for me to read in this book published in 2011, an acknowledgement published by Oxford University Press of the difficulty of accepting this view that it arose naturally. Here's what these writers said. They still believe in the standard model that life started, you know, coming up the ladder, but they pause before the problem of photosynthesis. In summary, evolving oxygenetic photosynthesis involves bringing together several major components, each of which has a number of potentially difficult steps in its evolution, and the overall scenario must somehow fit together in a way that each stage is selected for, at least not rapidly selected against. While some promising scenarios have been put forward, and nature may have offered a helping hand in assembling the water-splitting complex, we are still far from sure how it was done. Creating the whole looks formidably difficult, and far harder than evolving any of the forms of anisogenic photosynthesis we see today. When faced with trying to explain how a complex and beautiful system such as oxygenetic photosynthesis arose, the challenge for biologists is to show how it could have happened by plausible evolutionary steps, and we are still a long way from reaching this goal. So we are left with explaining this 21% oxygen in the atmosphere, because it can only come from living things, and it can only come from photosynthesis. And that is a very difficult mechanism, machinery to the hilt, very quantum, depends on the quantum effect, to work. That's a very difficult thing to explain. Now, there's a new site called Recovering from Religion. I want to take a little detour here, which you can join. If you are one of the many people who have determined that religion no longer has a place in their life, but are still dealing with the after effects in some way or another, Recovering from Religion may be just the right spot for you. And there's their logo, Living After Faith. And one of their logos is, or one of their sayings is a quote from Mark Twain, faith is believing what you know ain't so. Christadelphians are not into that at all. We want to base our faith on real evidence. But I want to show you now, because I can hardly believe what I read, we're going to take a look at when you're confronted, our non-theist friends are confronted with the problem of photosynthesis, how some of them have reacted, and how this might play out on a young mind. So this goes back to 2002. This was in Science Journal. I want you to read this. We've just seen that photosynthesis is an unbelievably elegant design system. The process of photosynthesis is a very complex set of interdependent metabolic pathways, said Robert Blankenship, professor of biochemistry at Arizona State. How it could have evolved is a bit mysterious. Now he's going to tell us how it evolved. You ready? Photosynthesis is one of the most important chemical processes ever developed by life, a chemical process that transforms sunlight into chemical energy, ultimately power virtually all the living things, and allowing them to dominate the earth. The evolution of aerobic photosynthesis in the bacteria is also the most likely reason for the development of an oxygen-rich atmosphere that transformed the chemistry of the earth billions of years ago, further triggering the evolution of complex life. So we've talked about that. You can't have complex air-breathing animals without the production of oxygen. Now he's going to tell us how it happened. Blankenship argues that different pieces of the system, listen to this, think about that candy machine, argues that different pieces of the system evolve separately in different organisms, perhaps to serve purposes different from their current function in the photosynthesis, brought together either by fusion of two different bacteria or by the recruitment of lots of genes. The new combination of genes resulted in a new combined system. And what's his analogy? This kind of evolution in bacteria is kind of like what happens at a junk dealer. Are you kidding me? This was in Science Journal. Bits and pieces of whatever there is out there in the yard get hauled back and welded together and made into this new thing. All these metabolic pathways get borrowed and bent a bit and changed. That's been put forward to students, that kind of rhetoric. So we're just going to look a little more for a minute at what goes on in this cell. Photosynthesis, which is so totally integrated, why would they use the analogy of going to a junk shop and a junkyard and some bacteria exchange genes, and next thing you know, we had photosynthesis? Here's why. There's an agenda out there. And this is, I guess his name is on the next slide. Richard Lewontin, who taught at Harvard for many years, just recently retired. This was from 1997. Here's what he said. Our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failures to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institution of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive. We see an elegant system like photosynthesis. No way is it designed. It came out of a junkyard somehow. No matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiative, moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. The eminent Kant scholar Lewis Beck used to say that anyone who could believe in God could believe in anything. To appeal to an omnipotent deity is to allow that at any moment the regularities of nature may be ruptured, that miracles may happen. So we're going to turn his argument. What is a just-so story? That's what he said he was willing to accept. It describes an unverifiable and unfalsifiable narrative explanation for a cultural practice, a biological trait, or behavior of humans or other animals. The use of the term is an implicit criticism that reminds the hearer of the essentially fictional and unprovable nature of such an explanation. So there's a just-so story in the Bible. Let's see how well you're going to accept that. We know what it is. It's Aaron. Oh, Moses. Moses, please. The people compelled me. You know, they brought their gold and their ornaments and what can I do? Because a golden calf just leaped out of the fire. Is that right, Aaron? You expect me to believe your just-so story? Now I'm going to tell a just-so story of my own. We can have our next person up here. So here's the just-so story. We're going to assume that... What's your name?
Nathan.
Welcome, Nathan. So we're going to assume that you and I live out in Wyoming, in a very backward village. And it was when one of your life's desires to go to New York City, and you've just come back from New York City, and you brought back with you metal models, aluminum models, here, feel it. You brought back these aluminum models from New York City of the Twin Towers, the Chrysler Building, and the Empire State Building. And you really like these. You're going to only go to New York City once in your life. And you have me over to your house, and I like them too. In fact, I covet them. And while you're in the other room, I put them in my knapsack and leave your house. You notice they're missing. You ask me if I know anything about where they are, and I say no. One day you're over at my house, and lo and behold, you see in my Cheerio cabinet these same models. And you say to me now, Bill, aren't those mine? You say that to me.
Bill, aren't those mine?
Oh, no, Nathan. You know where these came from? I was heating some aluminum out in my backyard, and it was a really windy day, and, the wind came out, and these came out. Here, feel them. I really like them, too. Would you believe my story?
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you went into a court, which is a trier of fact or a finder of fact, I think I'd have a very difficult time convincing the judge. But I'll tell you what I would do if I was a judge. I would say, Mr. Fair. No, I wouldn't use Mr. I'd say, okay, Fair. I'll tell you what. Next time we have a windy day, I'll be over to see you the next day. That's a just-so story. And in my opinion, if we can go back to the PowerPoint, in my opinion, when we see these just-so stories, can we go back to PowerPoint, Frank? How believable is my story? Well, it's not very believable, but there's four stories that I believe are equally believable. A golden calf just leaked out of the flames. Aluminum models of New York City buildings were created by wind blowing around in liquid aluminum built backyard. That robotic machine we saw. Hey, Fred, go down to the junkyard, get some used refrigerator parts, and we'll build. No, you won't. No, you won't. It's an elegant design machine. And lastly, the elegant process of photosynthesis arose by random lateral gene shuffling in bacteria. They're all equally credible as just so stories in my mind. Now we're coming to the end of our remarks, and I apologize to the person that we didn't do this demo with, but we're going to have to move on. My apologies, it just got away from me. There's another issue with the chlorophyll molecule. We're wrapping up our remarks here. The fact is that not all stars have the same, they're different colors because they emit different colors of light. What did I say about that, this window that they drop on Hamburg?
Tuning matters,
thank you. Well, a couple of years ago, a couple of astronomers wrote a little ditty, star light, star bright, any oxygen tonight? And for the majority of stars, the answer is no. Because most of the stars are not tuned to the chlorophyll molecule. Either they are up here in the blue range, in which case they will burn up everything, they are ultraviolet, they'll destroy anything to do with light. Or 80% of the stars are down here in the red dwarf. They don't have the energy to energize the chlorophyll molecule. So it's about 7% of the stars have the right spectrum to energize the chlorophyll molecule. Roughly, so when you hear that there's billions and billions of stars, well, first of all, they have to respond to the, they have to be tuned to the chlorophyll molecule. And here's how close the tuning is. There's the spectrum of the sun right here, and that's the spectrum of the sun. There's the absorption spectrum of chlorophyll. You'll notice where it does not absorb is right here in the green area. It reflects it, and that's of course why we see green. It absorbs over here in the blue and over here in the red, A and B chlorophyll. So the chlorophyll molecule is tuned very carefully to the spectrum of the sun. And it's interesting, and it's caused non-theists some difficulty, that our eyes are the most sensitive in the green area of the spectrum, the very area where chlorophyll reflects. You'll notice in this auditorium that they have switched the exit signs from red to green. You'll notice that most of you will find those exit signs much clearer because we do respond, our eyes do respond to green rather than red. The other thing that is of interest, which is caused, and we could spend a lot of time on, but we're not going to, is this, that the spectrum of the light actually hitting the Earth from the sun over here, the maximum energy after it's filtered out by all the water vapor, CO2, nitrogen, etc., in the atmosphere is tuned very, very closely to the maximum response of chlorophyll A and B. There's a very, very close relationship. And I just want to say this in passing. If, in fact, Genesis is true, we would expect to see this tuning with the existing atmosphere rather than some ancient atmosphere. Had it been some ancient atmosphere, we would expect to see, there's a lot of literature on this, the chlorophyll molecule would have evolved over here. But in fact, it's tuned to an atmosphere, the sunlight coming through in the current atmosphere. So life introduced free O2 into the environment through the evolution of photosynthesis. This is what this one book says here. We try to point out that's a tough sell, because you don't explain photosynthesis in a sentence, how it came to be. The chlorophyll molecule took 15 years by itself to synthesize, and the cell had to do the same process, only it does it much more quickly and much more elaborately. The great oxygenation event, also called the oxygen catastrophe or oxygen crisis or great oxidation, was biologically induced appearance of free oxygen. Somehow or other, biologically, oxygen was introduced into the Earth's atmosphere. And we're going to wrap up now. Animals need oxygen. You cannot evolve animals like this without having a significant amount of oxygen, says geochemist Dick Holland of Harvard University. Does everybody here get it? That without oxygen, you don't have anything here. You don't have a theory of evolution. You don't have anything, because without oxygen coming through photosynthesis, you can never evolve air breathers. You don't have oxygen. And any oxygen, little oxygen that will appear, will be bound up with other elements. And we can't breathe rust. So this issue of oxygen in the atmosphere has become a very important issue as a result of looking out into outer space, looking for signs of life on exoplanets. Without the great oxidation event, which he believed occurred somewhere 2.3 billion years ago, we would not be here. It's just that simple. And photosynthesis is the way. And it's a very difficult thing to find your way through it if you're a non-theist, because it has every evidence of intricate design of the highest order. We could not be here. No dinosaurs, no fish, no snakes, just a lot of microorganisms. Scientists are making progress on understanding the great oxidation event, but still greater mysteries remain to be unraveled in the saga of oxygen on Earth. Although we think we know when oxygen first appeared and arose, we know very little about its rise to the present level. You can't make it under 15%. We're at 21. Below 15%, our brains are designed. You can't think, because there's not enough oxygen feeding the brain to allow us to provide the energy to let us think. It's a very narrow window of that oxygen level, especially about the relationship between atmospheric oxygen and the development of animals. We're related. You can't explain oxygen. You got no theory of anything. We want to understand what controls the rise of oxygen on the Earth and maybe other planets. Oxygen is our best biomarker for looking for life on extrasolar planets. So here we are. Here we are. On this pale blue dot. And like a beacon in the night, when you go and do an analysis of the atmosphere on that pale blue dot, there is oxygen allowing the O3 ozone layer to protect the Earth, to protect life. It's like a beacon in the night. And the question is, what was the great oxidation event? What was it? In closing, we're going to look at the Bible. It's a myth, right? It's an allegory. It's not a book of science. It was borrowed from the Egyptians. It was borrowed from the Assyrians. It's anything but an historical narrative of what really happened. So let's just read it, right? This is a Bible school. Let's read the Bible. And I know it won't tell us anything, but to humor ourselves, let's read it. God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas, and God saw that it was good. What was the first thing that then apparently had to be done to make this planet habitable? Well, let's read. God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants. Plants, yielding seed. And fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kind, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and morning the third day. So let's bring in Bill Nye, just to refresh our memory about plants. The science guy, talking about plants. Don't tell me this one did. Well, that is unfortunate, to say the least. Frank, can you hit enter on this this one here? Yeah, go back and then hit enter, because this is fairly important, and what a place for a breakdown right here. Now, we got to go back, yeah.
Go back one more
if you can. Now try to hit enter and see if it goes. Ah, there we go. So we have these plants, apparently, the primitive Hebrew thought. But that's not going to do as much good. So what then apparently happened? Well, and God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from night, and let them be for signs and seasons for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of heaven, and to give light upon the earth. What frequency of light? Just any light? Or is it tuned to something? It's tuned to those plants that were created the day before. And when the light comes in and it's tuned to those plants that were created the day before, what do we get?
Photosynthesis.
We get oxygen. And if that was the end of it, and we were told the next day, air-breathing animals, oxygen-consuming animals were created, we know this was wrong, but it isn't. The fifth day, God said, let the water swarm with swarms of living creatures. Let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of heaven. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the sea and let birds multiply in the earth. So we have some air breathers, birds and some of the animals in the sea. But the key is, you're going to have animals in the sea, and the NIV treats it as teeming in the sea, then in fact you need food for them, And the big oxygen producers on this planet are in the seas. They are the heavy lifters. They are the powerhouses of where our oxygen comes from. You'll notice that the seas, the chlorophyll, this is a mapping of chlorophyll. It's the seas, particularly this time of year in the north. Phytoplankton are microscopic ocean plants that form the base of ocean ecosystems. They are so abundant, they are visible from space. And you can see where the chlorophyll is being produced, and everywhere where you see the chlorophyll, that is where the oxygen is being poured out into the atmosphere. We think, when we think about Earth's resources, sources of oxygen, we usually think of vast forests such as the Amazon, but about half of the oxygen we breathe comes from elsewhere. It's produced by phytoplankton. Phytoplankton are tiny single-cell plants that live in the ocean, and they serve as the base of the oceanic food chain. Yet important as phytoplankton are to life on Earth, their interaction with our planet has only been studied recently on a global scale. So, to conclude, I think mankind has had the explanation of the great oxidation event around for a very long time.
Thank you, Brother Bill, for all your words tonight, and all the helpers as well, too. Thank you very much for that.